And we're back. Welcome to it. It is, of course, On Air with Matthew James, Season 2, Part 2, Episode 1. Almost one whole year since the show started, right here on Spotify and on Apple Podcasts. I'm so excited to be bringing the second part of this series to you. Of course, today we're chatting to one of the most amazing gentlemen I think I've had the pleasure of meeting in my career, Sean Benson, who started out on General Hospital and, of course, is now known for his roles on shows such as The Boys and, of course, Tiny Pretty Things on Netflix. We're chatting about his journey through the industry, the lessons that he's learned along the way, and, of course, his advice and guidance to young industry newbies out there. Of course, if you'd like to get in contact with us, remember to give us a follow on social media. It's at Matthew James SA on Twitter and at Matthew Hallett on Instagram. Without any further ado, here's my interview with Sean Benson. We're chatting to Sean Benson, who, of course, is known for his roles on The Boys as well as Tiny Pretty Things. Of course, Sean, thank you so much for taking the time out to chat to me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I look forward to it.
Do you want to sort of walk us through your journey and how you became an actor? Was this something that you always wanted to do, or was there something else that you were planning to do growing up?
You know, it's such a good question because looking backward, it seems obvious. But when I was a kid, I just loved kind of everything. I was super curious, super motivated. So, you know, when I was 5 years old, I was playing piano and I was doing every sport I could. And by the time I was 10, I added in ballet dancing and modern dance. But also, you know, all through high school, I was either playing music or trying to get A pluses in my physics courses. And both were equally exciting to me. And same with the sport. Yeah. So, you know, I was really, like I said, I was really curious and motivated. And so by the time I hit my last year of high school, I auditioned for theater school, but I was also, you know, flipping a coin between going and doing what I eventually did, which is my biochemistry degree. Yeah. So now looking back, again, it feels like it unfolded just like it should have. But at the time, you know, I've got journal entries from my first year of university where I'm genuinely wondering if I should be a doctor or a lawyer. And then it was around second year in my university where I'd been doing a ton of plays at school. So I would do all my lab work and classes during the day. And then at night, I would go do dance shows and plays. And it just became really apparent to me which one was more exciting. And as I became, you know, entered into young adulthood, I realized that there was this sort of glorified idea of Hollywood that was all or nothing. But as I started to go see more professional productions and plays in and around Toronto, I started to realize that, oh no, there's like a real sort of rubber meets the road way to do this now. It's not all or nothing. It's just living that way and being an artist. And so that's when it became really clear to me, okay, this is your path now. But, you know, as a kid, I don't know, I always had an instrument in my hand or a skit in my head. But I'd be lying if I didn't say I also was thinking about my volleyball game and my math test.
Yeah, but you obviously, like you said, you've got a Bachelor's of Science in Chemistry and Biochemistry, but you also studied acting at the George Brown College. Now,
yes.
would you recommend that people actually want or actually study acting if they want to go into it full time as a career? Or can you say they can just go into it?
Okay, so this is a great question. I left theater school after 2 years. I dropped out, and I dropped out because I found it to be totally damaging because they functioned from an old paradigm of you're either brilliant or you're shit. And if you're shit, here are your issues. And if these are your issues, go work on them and we're not going to tell you how. Now, that was my experience. I didn't enjoy it, except quite literally in 3 hours, I'm going to meet one of my best friends from 25 years who I met at theater school. I've made works with other people. And the thing is, within 2 months of dropping out, I was doing like Fringe and Summer Works festivals. Within 4 months, I was on the main stage in Toronto doing theater with all the good companies. So obviously I learned a lot there. Obviously, whatever I found to be damaging was also partnered with, you also spent 2 years to the point where upon exiting that place, you basically could walk onto all the best stages in town. So I can't shit on it too much. Now, if somebody were to say to me right now, hey, my kid's 18, they want to be an actor, I'd say it's a harder road, and it's weird with COVID, but like go get a waitering job downtown. Make all the money you can. Don't take any from your parents, and take a Meisner course. Get into some therapy, maybe. Find a core group of people, and it's harder because at theater school you're given that, but most of them aren't going to go on and be self-motivatedly awesome. So it's a tougher route to sort of find your own path of instruction. So the short answer is definitely get some training, because even just learning something like, I'm not a fan of on-camera courses, but even learning how you look on camera, or having, hey, every Sunday night you have to do scenes in front of people. It's a good way to figure out if you're any good at this or not. And the thing with acting classes for me, like when I went to Los Angeles years later, I was already, you know, doing well as an actor. But when you get in that class, you get a pretty quick idea of a pecking order. And I know that we live in a world that's moving more and more in a very participation is positive and inherently positive aspect. And I'm for that, but there's also something about being in an acting class and looking around and going, I think I'm fundamentally knocking this out of the park better than everyone, except for that person over there. I had this in an acting class where I was, you know, doing good work, and it was recognized I was doing good work, and you know, all the other students wanted to work with me, and there was this one woman, and I was like, holy shit, I can't do what she can do. And so it was great because the pecking order internally was established. And then I ended up saying to that woman, hey, what's your deal? Like, why are you so fucking good at that? And then she ended up teaching me or bringing me to a place where I learned a lot of stuff. So it's a navigation of a life in an industry. And that's the thing with theater school, is it's such a sheltered thing that I think it's a false navigation of a life in an industry.
And I think also going to an actual training course or school actually takes away that glamour that people see, because obviously everyone looks at the world of acting and the entertainment industry as such a glamorous industry, but they don't actually see the hard work that goes into it. So I think if they sort of go to the school as well, they sort of would get the idea of how much work is actually put into a project or into a play or into a series or movie.
100%. And it's really a good way to put it. I mean, the one thing that theater school did prepare us for is, you know, we were working in the basement of a technical college, and some days we'd be rehearsing in and amongst sofas that were being reupholstered. That's the only space they would allocate to the theater program. And it sets you up for 20 years later. You're working on a show like The Boys, and you're in a dusty warehouse at 2 a.m. shooting, you know, and you're sort of like, well, this is always how acting and entertainment has been. You have to sort of be the circus that shows up, finds the space where no one's too bothered by it, entertain the shit out of everybody, and move on to the next town. And I love it. It's a very, you know, it's weirdly glamorous for how unglamorous it all is. But there's the in-betweens. I mean, you know, a successful year as an actor, you can work years that have allowed me to buy houses. I've worked 50 days. Now, I'm not trying to be gauche about, you know, I obviously had good pay on those 50 days. What I mean is that means for 1 out of 7 days a year I'm working, and for 6 out of 7 days I'm not. And so you really have to learn how to be sort of self-motivated and also enjoy your life away from acting. And so, you know, all the ups and downs of a theater school are valid. But I also think more valid is the path I described, which is you have your acting class on Sunday night, you have your voice class on Tuesday night. And other than that, you're just living. And that's actually a more accurate reflection of what your career will end up being.
And your father was an English professor and novelist and a playwright. Would you say that this is one of the reasons that you sort of also led into a creative
field? You know, I don't think it's one of the reasons. You know what, that would be inaccurate. I mean, when you grow up and there's books on theater all around the house, and my mom also, I think it was her master's or PhD, was on, you know, German expressionist drama. So they both had this inherently academic love of the theater and everything that goes with it, including ultimately TV film. So they weren't in the industry whatsoever, but at the same time, there was just an environmental, they're old world European. So I grew up with opera in the house and classical music in the house and a piano in one corner and a banjo in another corner. And, you know, classic movies, Hitchcock playing every third night in between the Remington Steele episodes and Love Boat episodes. So there was a love and appreciation for it all. That was just, this is part of your life. Yeah. I never had to seek culture. I never had to seek theater. But believe me, when I was like, hey, I'm off for biochem, there was no sense of, wait, why aren't you going to go be an artist? The flip side is when I call and go, hey, just to let you guys know, I'm going to go into theater now. They were like, great, we're ecstatic, good for you. So they're also like that. Like my parents, for any flaws that any family or parents bestow upon their kids, they were supportive of whatever I chose to do or be.
Yeah. And they were obviously very excited when you actually decided to go full-time into the creative field.
Very excited. And the other thing, too, you know, if I go back to age 14, you know, Guelph, Ontario, Canada was a relatively small town. I mean, and by relatively small town, I mean, I don't know, it was almost 100,000. So it's not like a village or anything. But basically, you know, I'm 14 years old. I'm dancing ballet. I have earrings. I have long hair. And, you know, bro dudes at school are wanting to fight me every day and picking on me and calling me all this stuff. And you know, when you're being called a faggot and people are trying to fight you every day, and then you go home and your dad just loves your outfits and your earrings and your style. It's really nice because it would be, I actually think it would be harder to have your friends support you, but your parents not support you. Because that's so primordial and primal is your relationship with your parents. And so, so even though my dad was this weird sort of stubborn old Irishman growing up, he had such an appreciation for whatever flamboyant shit I was pulling. It made that aspect of expression. I mean, that's really what I'm talking about is expression. Is that by the time you're 16, 17, 18, and you feel like you can express yourself fully, the arts is definitely an available career.
And you're quite multi-talented. I know, like you said, you grew up with all of these instruments in the house, but you've also done a bit of directing and you're also acting and you play a bunch of musical instruments. Now, would you say in the current climate, one is still able to just focus on being an actor and not have any other specific skills? Or would you say it's more recommended that people have multiple skills when they have it on their CV and they're more, you know, chosen for the job because of their CVs being that
bad? I don't think it helps your CV in any real one way, in the sense that I don't think CV matters. I really don't. I think that, you know, everything is such a per project basis. So, for example, I'm prepping a short right now that I'm directing and I don't have to show anybody a resume for that. People just kind of know I do that work. Now, if you're younger, I think sometimes being a polymath is more difficult and sometimes it's an advantage, and only you'll find out later when you look back at your path. Like, I actually think some days my life would have been easier if I just was a introverted actor. And I look at some of my friends who are that way, and it was almost easy for them to focus and just be like, this is what I do, period. You know, I literally there was a couple of years where there was a writer strike in Los Angeles, and my agent in Toronto was like, yeah, just come home and work in Toronto. It'll be great. And I was like, yeah, but I'm in this band in Los Angeles and we're doing well and we're getting paid and we're making an album. And, you know, I don't know if that's a great idea to put your acting career on hold for a year and a half to make an album with your band. But I do know it was one of the best times in my life. And so, you know, career-wise, I'm not sure what the best choices to make are for anybody else. But for me, I've always had to pursue those things that are most interesting in front of me at the time, unless there's just like an obvious reason not to. Like, I once was offered a TV show and I turned it down three times because it was, I just had a path towards things I wanted to do in Los Angeles. I was a young actor and this thing came up in Vancouver. And finally, when they said, well, what if we structure your contract this way? It became so obvious that it was a good idea. But before that, it wasn't.
Yeah.
Now, if you look at what the contracts were before that, some people would be like, you'd be crazy to turn that down. And I was like, yeah, but it's my life. And if my life is me in Toronto acting on a series, but regretting that I didn't do the band, versus playing the band thing out and then finally moving back to Toronto, we were either going to get signed or we weren't. We didn't. And it was like, great. But at least I know I put all my cards on the table. And by the way, rightly or wrongly, that's been part of my journey. And I don't even know if I recommend that to other people. Sometimes I've had to play things too far.
But that makes so much sense to obviously evaluate the situation as it arises. Obviously, you can't obviously make a blanket decision before the time, before you even start your career, to say, you know, I'm only going to do
no. And we try.
You just sort of
we try. Yeah. We, you know, at theater school, we all tried to talk about the kind of actor we wanted to be, and it's like, you don't even know what kind of actor you are today. How can you predict what kind of actor you're going to be in 5 years? Like, the you know, I remember a bunch of us were like, we'd never do Friends. That series is too, you know, limiting and blah blah blah. And it's not real art. And it's like, I don't. Maybe Friends isn't my favorite show, but what a gift that would be to be on that show. But it's that, young stuck in a basement. Like, we know better. The flip side is, I don't trust any young person who doesn't think they know better. Like, I think that's what we want young people to do, is show up and be like, I have all the answers. And then you get a little bit of wisdom and you're like, hey, your energy is amazing. What you want is amazing. However, you literally have zero idea how it goes. And that becomes the sort of generational struggle of like boomer versus Gen X versus millennial versus zoomer. Like, it's hilarious to watch all this. And total side note, I mean, I actually fit in. I'm too young for Gen X. Now, on paper, that's not true. Yeah. But in reality, when Gen X was happening, I was too young. Like, there's a Gen Y2K that's sort of been forgotten. And so actually, age-wise, I'm not Gen X when it was happening, but I'm definitely not a millennial. And so it's funny to sit on the sidelines and watch as all these different generations negotiate with each other, but they're just doing what every generation's done. You know, the greatest generation thought hippies were a bunch of losers because they'd fought wars and the hippies were protesting wars. And it's like, it's a beautiful turning of the wheel. And so I think the idea that when we're young artists, we think we have all the answers. We think everybody who's made a movie who's older than 35 is shit, other than like three greats, and the more obscure, the better. You know, I used to think that about Spielberg. And when I rewatch, I don't mean like E.T. or Jaws, but I remember watching Save It Private Ryan being like, that schmaltzy, blah, blah, blah. And I rewatched it recently. I was like, it's an excellent movie. It's excellent, you know. And
But you've also grown and you've got a better understanding for how the industry works and how it takes to, or what it really takes to become a director. So I think also going back and looking at things that you now have more knowledge on, you obviously admire it.
Also the humanity. That's all correct. But also the humanity is that you learn a bit more about how the world works and what love is and what loss is and what standing at a tombstone and wondering if you've lived a good life is because other people sacrificed for you. I mean, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen Saving Private Ryan, but that didn't mean anything to me at age 21 when I was like, what is this? The war scenes are good, but this is cheesy. Yeah. But as an adult, you look at that and you go, that's actually the whole fucking point of the movie. And it's beautiful. Yeah. So it's nice to revisit the greats without the chip on my shoulder of youth. But again, like I say, if I have an acting student or I'm directing someone and they don't come in kind of going, fuck you, I know how to do this better, I almost feel like they're dead. Yeah. I'm like, no, we want you bucking against the goad.
And when you look at your career now, what do you think is, what would you define as your breakout role, if you can even pin one down?
I absolutely can. It was the first TV series I did because I had been doing theater in Toronto for, I think, 3-4 years. And then I'd been auditioning a lot and not getting any roles. I mean, not like a two-line or nothing. Yeah. And my agent at the time was really supportive. And she basically would just call me in and be like, honey, they think you're crazy or on drugs. And I, you know, I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'm getting dropped by the best agent in Canada today. And she'd be like, but they can't wait to see you next week. Keep it up. And when we finally sort of cracked how for me to be, because what would happen is I'd go into these auditions and I'd be doing too much. But what I'd be doing would be interesting. I was swinging for the fences. I was not mumblecore. I was not neutral. It was the exact opposite. It got me noticed. It didn't get me roles. But by the time I finally navigated how to sit still and talk to the person opposite me, and for anybody listening, that's literally like you have to have all the juice of someone who wants to swing for the fences, but you have to be able to sit still and talk. And if you can't do that, you're doing too much for 90% of the scene work you're going to do. So when I finally cracked that, I booked a lead in a TV series. So I'd never worked, and all of a sudden I was number one on the call sheet shooting a law series. And within weeks, I was on the cover of TV Guide mags and doing the night show, talk shows and all that kind of thing. So regardless of ups and downs I've had since, and there's been many, immediately I was a name actor, and I've never not been since within Canada. And so there's no way that that wasn't the breakout role. Period. Yeah. You know, and that same year I ended up shooting my first film, which was K-19 with Catherine Bigelow and Harrison Ford and Liam Neeson. And so the 1-2 punch of those just sort of set me up as a guy who's like, yeah, we'll see what happens with your career, but you now have a career.
And what would you say, if it's even that job, is the job that's taught you the most lessons about yourself and about your craft, really? Would you say it's your breakout role? Or is there another role that you've done that's taught you so much about acting and about
General Hospital taught me more when it comes to all of that stuff. When I was shooting, the way the soap opera shoots, it's called cross shot. And that means that if you and I are in a room having a conversation, there's four cameras working at all times. And so your coverage and my coverage are happening at the same time. So that first show taught me the most about having to be able to deliver a take, not a scene, having to deliver a close up, not a scene. You know, you start to learn what the difference is. So that was really important. And the learning curve was steep. But when I got to General Hospital, I discovered Meisner and that way of working. And I really finally understood what being truly in the moment was. And being able to shoot these scenes with my scene partners on the show, where we were acting in real time, they were getting both our coverage at the same time. And I was therefore able to, you know, the shooting schedule of a soap is practically 5 days a week and you're shooting an episode a day. So it's I was able to experiment with not only what acting was, who I was as an actor, now that I had a bit of experience and wasn't as worried about the technical. And then the idea of that cross shooting, when I directed my first film, I cross shot to shoot a feature in 14 days because otherwise it would have been impossible. So what I learned from that, the other thing is that, you know, I had been struggling with and falling prey to addiction and alcoholism. And so that all came to a head on General Hospital because, you know, I'm in LA. I'd already had all those issues. But by the time I hit Los Angeles and was working on that show, I had money. I had free time in between. I had status and I had free reign to go do whatever I wanted at night. And so the second part of your question was learning about, you know, technical and acting, but also myself and hitting the wall of something so deeply destructive that is within me. There's no one to blame. There's not even me to blame, in fact, because it is really a sickness. So I don't think I've ever learned more about myself or acting or technique than that sort of 1 to 2 years in and around that time.
And as a director, both Stopkiss and Bond Wedding won a few awards. In your opinion, what makes a great director or an award-winning director? What do you think it is about you that's made these projects so successful?
Those to me are two questions. The one is what made my project successful, and that was my ability to work with the actors in a way that their relationship with one another while the curtain was up or the cameras were rolling was so fucking real and so genuinely connected. So that for me is that. That's why those worked. You know, if you look at, let's say, Barn Wedding, the film I directed, the directorial swooshes were few. I think there's two or three moments in there that are very guided. The camera's guided. The rest is about the performances being shot in a way that amplifies the simple excellence of them. And that was the same with Stopkiss, is that I think there's two flourishes I put in the whole play that had anything to do with me as a way to highlight. The rest was the work with the actors. Now, when I'm an actor, what I think makes an excellent director is clarity. I think when a director comes up and is just clear, they can do it in 10 seconds or in a minute. But sometimes a director will come up and give notes. And when they walk away, you're like, I have no fucking idea what they just suggested. Or there's no actionable way to do anything they suggested. And usually these are the directors who are not yet awesome, but are very into the idea that they're awesome. In other words, there's a bit of ego about how they give notes. The more grounded directors I've worked with, they just come up and they go, really love what's happening, need you to amp it up a little for the last sort of page. Other than that, let's give it a shot. And you just kind of go, great. Now I know that I can ease into the top. Let's amp up at the end. They don't try and get too specific about what that means because they want to let you, you know, be yourself about it. And, you know, when I think over 20 years, those directors who just give you a little nudge and then they go back to doing their thing, because the director's got to handle everything, right? You're sitting there thinking you're creating the world with your performance. And to everybody watching or listening, you're not. You're creating such a sliver of what the ultimate product is. And it's actually a beautiful thing. It's a freeing thing. I know a lot of young actors, especially theater background, can get really frustrated because you're not really playing these swooping, great, full, long takes when you're doing the TV show or the blockbuster movie. And the reality is that's a very freeing thing because you now get to come in and you sometimes, other than like which hand you lift something with, don't even need to be continuity conscious in terms of your own energy, because what they'll do is they'll go edit together a performance that you never gave. So when you, when we can get our heads around this, it all becomes very freeing. And when a director can work with you in that understanding, I consider that to be a great director.
Exactly. And do you think because you've been an actor for such a long time that when you started directing, it was a lot more easier for you to be a director because you sort of knew how to give the advice and how an actor would take it and what sort of advice?
I think it helped. I think it helped for sure. I mean, I was working with my, I co-created this next piece, but then, that I'm directing, but then we started acting rehearsals this week. So, you know, I'm working with her and she was just like, oh my fucking God, I forgot how good you are at this part, because we've been doing technical producing stuff and it's because we're really breaking down the humanity of it. And we're not breaking down the fake humanity. And what I'm really trying to say is that I've worked with a lot of directors who have no idea what actors really do in terms of arriving at something. And again, going back to the theater school idea, we used to make fun of directors who'd be like, louder, faster. It's like, what a bullshit note. Louder, faster is an incredible note, because I totally understand what you're asking for and I can totally do it. Exactly. And if you come up to me and you put your arm around me and you go, you know, I'm thinking back in this kid's childhood that you're playing, maybe his dad didn't give him a present one birthday. And you'll look at the director and be like, Bill, I love you. I have no idea what you're asking for. And he'll be like, if you could just maybe put your hand down when the camera comes around. I'm like, great. So FYI, you can ask me the most technical things you want. You don't need to cloak it in backstory. I don't know if that's, I try to bring that forward to the actor. And, you know, I teach karate, by the way, and we have a pretty good, If you're in front of me doing, let's say, a kata, which is the patterns that sort of get passed down through the style, I can't give you six notes. You can't implement six notes in a 45-second kata. You can implement one, maybe two. So the key is to go, what's the next single or maybe two notes that will move this forward? And once you can get really piecemeal that way, the work can get really good, because it's just like, okay, now the skill that comes over time is going, what is that note? What would be that thing? Yeah. But that's where the teaching I've done has really helped, because I fell so in love with the Meisner work that I dedicated myself to learning the complete sort of system. I hate to put it that way. It sounds a little pedantic, but when I started shooting a bunch of stuff, including in other languages, I realized how well it was working. So I started teaching it. So what happened is, over the last decade, whenever I'm not shooting, I teach, and I'll be watching. I've usually watched 10,000 hours of other students doing the work with me going, try it this way. And so for better or worse, my own instrument of, this is what I think the next 45 seconds could be better if you try it this way, I think that's gotten pretty good.
And like you said, you do so many things. Like, now you've even told us that you're a karate sensei as well. What sort of keeps you pushing and keeps inspiring you to push into these various avenues in the industry?
I don't know that I can take any credit for it. I mean, you know, I'm born into a house with certain genetics and have a certain energy that I don't really, it's not like I didn't do anything to be an 18-year-old who really loved karate when he walked into the room. I didn't do anything to be the 28-year-old who's, you know, starting to struggle with booze and drugs, but for somehow still does karate. You know, the one thing though, and this is an idea that I really stress. When I was 30 years old, I hadn't really played guitar much for my 20s. I was so focused on acting and partying. And I kind of woke up one day and I was playing a little bit of shitty guitar because I'd forgotten how to play all my high school stuff. I could barely play. And this little voice in me said, because I was kind of frustrated. I was like, fuck, man, you forgot all of it. And I kind of put the guitar down and I was like, I already sold my guitars. I had one acoustic kicking around. And I was like, you are going to be 40 years old one day. You can be 40 years old and really good at guitar, or you can be 40 remembering you once played in high school. And so I just quietly started to practice this and that. Now, as luck would have it, someone heard me in LA and needed a rhythm player for a band. Now, rhythm I could do because I hadn't forgotten the basic chords. Then that led to meeting this guy, this guy, this guy. And the next thing you know, 3 years later, I'm playing like main stage at the House of Blues, songs we've written for sold out like audiences. And, you know, we have fans who are singing back songs we've written to us. Like it was, it was a pretty cool journey with that. But because of having been fired from General Hospital for the drugs, I had a lot of downtime. And in that downtime, I played a lot of guitar. And so it was like hours and hours a day to get back to a level where I could actually play guitar. So the point, though, is that I don't know what gave me that drive, because I don't really, you know, I can't take much credit for it. But I do know that idea that, you know, I started jiu-jitsu when I was 41. I'd been doing karate since I was 18, but I was like, you know, I really want to get into the grappling. And most people don't start jiu-jitsu in their 40s. Like, it's a really, it's a damaging, hardcore, everybody tweaks out their joints and their knees and pops ribs, and that's all happened to me. And it's like, well, one day I'm going to be 50, 55. I can be a black belt in jiu-jitsu, or I can be a guy who wishes he was. That idea is something I hold on to,
And that's what kept you, And during this past year, obviously, like, a lot has changed in our industry. Sort of, what challenges have you faced personally or professionally, and how did you go about overcoming this?
I mean, there's professional challenges, which is just that work slowed down. I had a beautiful job I was going to shoot in France that was in a feature film I was so excited to do. And the lockdowns over there, they pulled my visa, so I didn't get to do that job. So there was actual things that went away because of lockdowns, et cetera. Now, on the flip side, you know, I have gotten to shoot some stuff, and the year's been fine as far as it goes. Just not ideal. And so that's been a challenge, is just to go, okay, you have to accept this as a quarantine, COVID, once in a generation thing, we hope. And therefore, you know, you can't get too fussed if you only get to shoot like a bit of TV and one lead in a film. Like, that's not bad. But personally, the challenges weren't too great for a while. You know, my girlfriend moved in with me. We've been having a great day to day. My groove has been awesome. But I hit about a month and a half ago, maybe a month ago, just pure COVID fatigue. I'm sure we all have. And so that challenge is more personal, like how to get excited for a new day, how to get excited, because our response here in Canada has not been amazing. We don't manufacture vaccines, so everything's just way behind, you know. So we're watching a place like California, where 6 months ago they were the worst place in the world, and now they're the best. And we're sitting here, you know, kind of going, I have no idea when like a 70-year-old is going to get a vaccine. So there's a little bit of just, hey, Sean, just put one foot in front of the other, do what you can, make your own work. But there's some fatigue around it. The short answer about that too is I like to lean into things. So if I'm having a crappy day, I don't pretend I'm not. I just lean into it. You know, my girlfriend comes home and she's like, how you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm sad today. And then that, and then we'll, a couple of weeks ago, it was the anniversary of my mom's death, and we just watched like three of the saddest shows ever and spent five nights where like every episode made me cry. And it was nice to not pretend that wasn't happening. That doesn't work for me.
Yeah. And just sort of feel your feelings. I always tell people that, like, if you have emotions, you need to feel them to get past them, or else you're just going to keep carrying them with you. So I really like that answer that you gave. But this last year has been so super crazy for everybody. What do you feel is the number one lesson that you've learned from this year? Is it that you just have to sort of lean into things, or is there another lesson that you've learned from this last year, but that we've been locked up in our homes and slowly now opening up the world again?
Yeah, I think I've had a couple. I mean, the thing I realized in the first number of months when I wasn't too bothered is that I tend to do more things than I need to do. And that includes even coffees with like third and fourth tier friend acquaintances. You know, I tend to fill my time with a lot of stuff. And every New Year's, I have a lot of, you know, intentions or resolutions. And one that I carry through every year is do more of less, not less of more. You know, you already have like these sports you love and these martial arts you love and these friends you love, and you might not need more this year. You might need to spend more time with the ones you have. So that for me was a big thing when our worlds got smaller and we weren't just having dinner with a bunch of like awesome but random city acquaintances. I mean, this is one of the best things about living in a city like Toronto is you just like, hey, so-and-so's having a dinner, you go down and it's got a great vibe, and you and 15 people are all kind of chatting. And is that I maybe don't need that as much as I thought. I would like to do it now and then, but I don't really need it that much. So the big lesson for me is you might have everything you need without knowing it before you go seek other things. I think that's about it.
That's perfect. And your most recent projects, I mean, namely the Boys and Tiny Pretty Things, are huge successes. What was it like being part of those shows?
Awesome. I mean, there's no two ways about it. As a guy who started in indie Toronto theater, I remember one play I did. Granted, there was a snowstorm, but six people came and saw it. There were more people on stage than there were in the audience. And any, you know, comedians always talk about bombing and how you have to bomb to be a good comedian. If you've never bombed, you've probably never told a good joke because that's part of the journey.
Yeah.
And I think that's true with actors. Like, if you haven't played to an audience that's smaller than the cast, you might not have really been doing the thing because, well, first off, I always say, like, if this was the year 3000 and we're all wearing gray jumpsuits and our food is all provided through a pill and nobody has to worry about money, what would I be doing with my life? And the answer is quite literally every single thing I'm doing. And so if somebody's only wants to be an actor because they could get famous, or get TikTok fans, like, good for you. Great. That's all awesome. I want those things too. Not the TikTok, but you get it. Not real interested in that, but you know what I mean? Insta, sure. Give me a million followers. Why not? It'll only be a benefit for me. The point though is that if you remove all that, am I still standing in some lighted area telling stories? And the answer is yes. I always have. I always will. It's part of the thing that is, it gives me juice. And so when I'm doing that and there's six people in the audience, and then you fast forward 20 years later and the Tiny Pretty Things was the number one show in the world for, I think, just shy of 2 weeks. Yeah. The Boys was the number one streaming show in the world of all platforms for like 2 months, the season I was on it. It's a nice reward for the time you put in when no one was watching. It's like, I'll be doing this no matter what, but it's really nice. Like, I one day I was out at the record store and, you know, I literally had shaved my head. I had a big beard and just two kids walk up. They're like, dude, are you Ezekiel from The Boys? Now, you know, I get clocked now and it's, but to be just not even looking remotely the same and have fans care enough that they're like, I recognize that whatever they recognize. And I was like, yeah, dude, it's nice to meet you. And we had a nice chat and they were happy about it. And it was sort of like, oh yeah, man, that's part of the joy of this. And I know there are some genuinely introverted actors who really just never want to be you know, clocked that way. I enjoy it. I think it's great. I love when I see actors I like out and I'm in the business. I could contact them through my agent, but I still am like, holy shit, you know?
I know the world is sort of waiting for the news around Tiny Pretty Things 2 or season 2. Can you give us any information on like the release dates, production dates, or what we can sort of
Everybody's waiting the same as you from the inside out. I don't know the specifics, but shifting teams at Netflix and all that kind of thing means that everything's a little bit like, you know, hurry up and wait for news, whether or not and how things are going to happen. So I can't give you anything on that, I'm afraid, because I don't know.
But what are some of the plot lines that you'd like to explore for your character?
Well, you see where we ended, you know, in episodes 9 and 10, is I think that the one thing I love about Brooks is that he's a good person. He's actually one of the moral centers of the show, if you watch back. I mean, he cares about the student. He's brisk and he's harsh, but he cares. And that's one of the things that I really like about him and Alan's relationship is that nobody's having affairs between those two. Nobody's like, you know, everybody else is cheating, lying, stealing, manipulating, and they just aren't. And so to me, there's two fun things I'd like to see. One is if we flip that on its head, which is they become, you know, Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. Or the other would be quite the opposite, is that they actually maintain that center but fully take over. Now that means they'd have to be manipulative in terms of planning, like a good chess game, but they don't have to be manipulative in terms of breaking rules. So these are just some ideas that are being bounced around and that I fully support. So there's a lot to play with there.
And with the industry sort of reopening now post-COVID, how do you see things sort of changing for the entertainment industry?
Well, I definitely see a lot more things being evaluated on the merits of how necessary is the sex, how necessary is the group scene. Like, I don't think COVID, we're gonna live with COVID, you know. I don't think COVID disappears. I think COVID is something we start to live with. So already, you know, when you submit a script and if it's got a number of crowd scenes or sex scenes, the producer's first question is there a way to pare these down? The other thing is, and this is a beautiful thing, is that, you know, if you think about when the explosion of the Black Lives Matter protests happened last year, I think that was due, because about fucking time, like it's ludicrous what's happening. But also everybody was stuck home and therefore your average Instagram influencer couldn't just post what meal they had out at the bar they were sponsored to be at. So they, all of a sudden, people's attention was able to be focused where I believe it should have been. And all of a sudden you go, oh, this this movement has achieved far more than it would have if we weren't all home in a tinderbox. I say that because the thing that's changing in the business, and I see it firsthand in Toronto, is the demand from the top down for stories that are POC, from stories that are Indigenous, from stories that are LGBTQ. Like, there's been this wonderful shift in this little period. People are kind of going, I'm not sure that same old story is relevant. I'm not sure we need to see, you know, again, we talk about, I mentioned Friends earlier, like that never happens again. You don't just have six white dudes and gals who all look basically identical. Telling essentially the same story of will she, won't she, do they like each other? So I think that's a very cool thing. And you see a lot of, you know, 40 something white dudes like me bitching about it. And I'm like, guys, we're still always auditioning for these shows. I don't think you understand how entrenched our voice is. I'm really excited to be a part of those other stories. So I think that the tinderbox of everybody being shut in of, wait, fuck that, this can't happen anymore. We need to not just change the response in the moment, but we need to change representation. And to me, that's the, it's the best shift I've seen in the entertainment industry. And believe me, it will cost me a role down the road. I promise you at some point, you know, it's going to be like, oh, they're not auditioning, you know, white dudes for that. It's like, great. I don't care because I'm fine. All of dudes like me, we're going to be just fine. We got to get our careers off of a certain type of focus. In any case, I think that's actually one of the biggest shifts I'm seeing as I see scripts come across my desk. And it's a good shift.
Definitely. And what advice and guidance can you give to any aspiring industry newbies out there?
You know, advice is a tough thing because I'm not 19 or 22 in today's climate. So I don't know how much value there is. I mean, if you're Addison Rae, we know the value of TikTok. But if you're an average person, I don't know what the value of 30,000 followers is. I don't know if that's something you should spend time and energy working towards. I don't know if you should just, in other words, nobody could do what I did and get what I got out of it because the river they're doing it in has changed. And so I think my only advice, generally speaking, and I can't see this not being true ever, because this goes to the fundamental idea of what we're doing as artists, is walk failingly but unerringly, like just keep going toward your voice. You know, you will tell the bad story or the bad joke, or you will do the audition that's bullshit, but you tried for something, you went for something. Anytime you seek what quote unquote they want, you will not only not give it, because there's no such thing, but you will fail at possibly doing not what you wanted but what you could have done with fullness of voice. And so we get cast on who we are, right? We know the tone and the tenor of a Denzel or of a Matt Damon or of a Meryl Streep. They have a voice, and we need to find our own voices to offer something that can be relied upon. It is that voice can shift over time, of course, and we can have range within our voice. But walk toward your voice at all times, and if you're not sure what it is, take big swings, because you'll either find it or you'll fail, but you'll have new information.
Perfect. That's amazing. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day.
It's my pleasure, Matthew. Yeah.
It was absolutely amazing.
All right.
Thank you so much.
We'll see you on the dance floor.
Again, thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode. Of course, we'll be back right here on Spotify and on Apple Podcasts. Stay tuned to our social media for details on our next episode. It's at Matthew James SA on Twitter, at Matthew Hallett on Instagram. Thank you so much to Sean Benson for taking the time out of his day to chat to us and share with us. I hope you guys learned so much, and I look forward to seeing you all back here soon on air with Matthew James.